Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, as the United States Supreme Court deliberates over the future of birthright citizenship, we explore its historic roots in light of immigration, slavery, and indigenous peoples. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Today, we're going to talk about birthright citizenship in both of our segments, a particularly important topic the Supreme Court is considering. Since the end of the Civil War, as a result of the 14th Amendment, all persons born on American soil are American citizens. This is what we call birthright citizenship. Now, commentators often suggest that this provision of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was a way to overturn maybe the most infamous of all Supreme Court decisions, the Dred Scott decision that was partially responsible for the U.S. Civil War. But the roots of birthright citizenship actually run further back and deeper than that decision. The issue is about more than just the Dred Scott decision, or the better way to put it, the Dred Scott decision takes place in a historic context. It's a new book that explores the nature and discourses of immigration, immigration policy, citizenship memory in the U.S., and this history and citizenship memory as the foundation of birthright citizenship. Anna Law holds the Herbert Kurtz Chair in Constitutional Rights at CUNY Brooklyn College. She's the author of The Immigration Battle in American Courts and this very recently released book, as in last month released book, Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, African Americans, Native Americans, and Immigrants. We're going to start off talking about this book. Anna Law, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the book with us and sharing your thoughts on it.
Douglas, thank you for tracking the book down and reading it in advance of our interview. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, I am so thrilled to have you. You start the book off with an observation. I think it's a great way we can start the conversation. You say that there's actually been quite a bit of continuity throughout American history in immigration law and policy. What has been the consistent principles, themes within immigration law and policy throughout American history?
So when you have a legal historian or an American political development person who studies history on, like me, we're the most annoying people at the party because we say things like, okay, it seems like unprecedented times, but actually it's only slightly unprecedented because there are some continuities. So what are those continuities? One is the United States has always been very ambivalent about being a multiracial democracy. So we are a multiracial democracy, and at various points in time, we have been better at it in including more people or terrible at it by excluding systematically large groups of people. So that's one of the continuities that we continue to struggle as a nation with, okay, how inclusive do we want to be? The other continuity I would mention is that we are still a federal system of government. And in a federal system where the states and the national government share power, it's always a question of where's the dividing line between national and state and local control over migration. So today, it's mostly the federal government that's doing entry-exit policy, and it doesn't mean the states have no role, but the location of that line has continuously been contested across U.S. history, and the location has moved based on the politics of each era, and that's what my book was about.
And that seems particularly important because there's kind of an assumption that the federal government sets immigration policy, and the tensions between states, you know, sanctuary cities or sanctuary policies versus a federal government that it certainly, you know, since the election of Donald Trump has been much more aggressive at trying to police immigration with some very specific rules. So the book suggests that that tension is something that's been there really since the founding of the Republic. You suggested we're at a stage now where the federal government does have a lot more control. What led to that control?
What led to that control is I think most Americans are not aware of the more than a century of first colonial and then state control over international and interstate migration. And so when I tell audiences that states used to run migration policy, and I get blank looks because we're not used to this concept when the federal government today runs immigration. So I said, when I mean states ran migration policy, I mean the state of Massachusetts was deporting people. They were deporting poor people to Europe, to Ireland, to other states. And the southern slave colonies were preventing free black sailors who were US citizens from getting off their ships and going into the state. So your question was, okay, what changed it? How did immigration become now entrenched at the federal level? And there are a number of factors, but the main one is that slavery was abolished with the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendments. And that might be jarring because readers are like, what does slavery have to do with migration? What it has to do with migration is the slave states were not going to allow federal control over entry and exit of international and internal borders when slavery existed. When slavery was politically defeated, the slave states stopped fighting. There were no more slave states. They stopped fighting to preserve state control over migration. And that's when it transitioned to the federal level, where that power largely remains today.
Yeah, interesting. Now, most discourses about the Supreme Court, at some point, somebody's going to reference originalism and the idea that the historical understandings, and in particular, originalism tends to focus on, what was the thinking at the founding of the Republic? What was the thinking at the creation of the Constitution or the creation of the amendments? So let's start with what were the founding fathers, for lack of a better term, what were the attitudes of the early Republic about immigration? Were they more welcoming? Were they more challenging? And the notion of birthright citizenship?
So there's different groups of founders, right? So let's talk about the founders when the US Constitution was written, which is what I think you're asking about. And you're asking at the founding, what were their the people who drafted the Constitution, what did they think about migration? They wanted it. They desperately wanted voluntary migration, but they also wanted enslaved importation. So what do you mean by, that's they wanted both types of migration for different reasons. And they also ran into the brute fact that there are Native Americans already living here. And so the question of, okay, how do we interact with Native nations and how do we live with them and among them? And so part of the reason the framers of the Constitution wanted more voluntary migration is to fight and to occupy the land and defend it against Native Americans who already lived there and are also defending their own territory.
That's one of the more interesting developments, within the book is the way that you include indigenous, the native populations. Because, I mean, first of all, that's not usually a part of the discourse on, US policy, towards immigration. Let's delve into that a little bit further. By including them, what is the argument that you're making about why indigenous populations are so important to this discourse?
So if you wonder, okay, so what do Native Americans have to do with immigration restriction? They have absolutely nothing to do with immigration restriction. And furthermore, they are not migrants. They are the original occupants and owners of the land. And they have a very distinct relationship to the land as the original people, and they have a distinct relationship to the US government and to state governments. So, why are they in my book? They are there because I wanted to explain to people that migration is one thing, to go where you want to go. The flip side of that coin is the right to remain, which sounds so weird to our current ears because what is that? But back in before the Civil War, the right to go somewhere into a state's territory did not also mean you had a right to stay there. Those were two different sets of policies, both managed at the state level. And Native Americans were not managed by states. They were the federal government was responsible for interacting with them, although states always got involved. And Native Americans are in my book because you see that Americans and many in the general public saw occupation of U.S. territory in what was formerly Native lands as relational and zero-sum. And so you see how these different groups, one group's ability to stay on their ancestral lands, indigenous people, was inverse to whether white people wanted their land. In the 1830s, in the Southeast, the slave owners greedily eyed Native land because they wanted to expand cotton growing and slavery. So different groups of people going to different places and staying in one place are not only relational, they're zero sum.
Yeah, it seems like one of the more essential questions then is if indigenous peoples are citizens or have the right to stay on land, then what does that mean about the constitutionality, not to say the morality, but just the legality and the constitutionality of things like the Indian Removal Act? So you're suggesting they wanted to be able to remove populations if they wanted the land.
Yes, you see, the Indian Removal Act is passed by the federal government by Andrew Jackson, who strong-armed members of Congress to vote for it. It's a federal law that creates a veneer of legality for the violent deportation of 80,000 Native people. Probably everyone knows the Trail of Tears and the Cherokee Nation's removal. That's 16,000 people, which is a lot of people. But in the 1830s in the Southeast, it was 80,000 people forced to the West, to what is now Oklahoma, to make way for white settler families and the expansion of cotton and slavery. So you asked about the citizenship of Native people, and that would take probably 10 books to explore and explain, but I will try to do it briefly. Native Americans, please don't assume that Native Americans want U.S. citizenship. Many of them do not. They want, you would have to ask each individual and each tribal nation, but they want their sovereignty and right of self-determination respected. So why Native Americans are one of the groups of people that are left out of the coverage of birthright citizenship in when the 14th Amendment was written is out of respect for their membership and citizenship in their tribal nations. And so U.S. citizenship, what is desired by African Americans and by Chinese immigrants and all sorts of other immigrants, is not uniformly desired at all by Native people. And we have to be careful about thinking about how citizenship is withheld from certain groups and then pushed upon Native people when they don't want it and why they didn't want it.
No, absolutely. And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're interviewing Anna Law. She has written a book recently released entitled Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, African Americans, Native Americans, and Immigrants in the Context of Birthright Citizenship, a particularly important case before the Supreme Court. Now, we've been talking about Native Americans, but when we think about the 14th Amendment, we think about birthright citizenship. African Americans, particularly slaves, former slaves, really seem to be at the center of that discourse. Is there a differentiation between voluntary and involuntary immigration, migration, the difference between people coming to the U.S. because they desired to versus obviously a large number of former slaves that are now freed that were brought against their will?
There is, and I'm very careful with my use of language. So before 1808, 1808 is when Congress passes a law abolishing the international slave trade, although slavery in the United States remains legal until after the Civil War. I call migration before 1808 because some of the migration into the country is unfree. And I would never call enslaved migration immigration. Immigration implies consent, which is totally absent from enslaved people. Enslaved people coming to the US is a migration. It is not a voluntary migration. Why they are in my book when they are not usually in US immigration history books is because the existence of slavery, I found multiple examples where the existence of slavery, that voluntary migration laws are affected and shaped by the existence of slavery. So that's why those two kinds of migration have to be clearly delineated, and also because one affects the other.
And then thinking about birthright citizenship, actually, I want to explicitly explore what was it in the Dred Scott decision that leads to the need for a 14th Amendment? I know a lot of people are familiar with the fact that it's an infamous decision, but may not know the details.
Okay, so Dred Scott v. Sanford, if you ask constitutional law types, what's the opposite of the greatest hits? Let's say the greatest misses of the Supreme Court. I mean, that is at the top. That is number one. So why is it such an infamous decision? It's because in hindsight, the Supreme Court got it wrong morally, got it wrong, legally. It doesn't comport with the Constitution, and it hastened the country's march toward a civil war. It's the case where the Supreme Court says that Black people, whether slave or enslaved or free, have no rights that white people need to respect. My goodness. So that is really doubling down on the idea that the United States legal citizenship is only open to white people. Black people, we don't care whether you're enslaved or free, you have no rights. And so the Civil War, and especially the 14th Amendment's Birthright Citizenship Clause, is an absolute repudiation of Dred Scott. And a repudiation of Chief Justice Roger Taney, who had the breathtaking assumption to say something like, "Well, when the framers in the original Constitution, they did not envision Black people having any rights or them being political equals," which is historically incorrect because there were some colonies and states that gave free Black people rights. So he's wrong historically. But the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship is to repudiate that terrible decision. And it's also to make clear this legal citizenship of free Black people. Enslaved people had no rights, but free Black people, what was their legal status? They were stateless. They tried to apply for passports at the State Department, and the State Department said, "No, you're not US citizens." Well, then, what are they? If they are not enslaved, if they are not citizens, if they're citizens of the state of Massachusetts, are they citizens of the state of are they citizens of the United States? If they are citizens of the state of Massachusetts, is US citizenship more important than state citizenship? None of that was clear until the Reconstruction Amendments.
Is it fair to say then that the birthright citizenship provisions in the 14th Amendment was just kind of a blanket statement because prior to that, citizenship clearly had a racial component to it. Obviously, for Native Americans, had different components, and that the framers of the 14th Amendment just said, let's flatten all of that and say, simply put, it doesn't matter about race, doesn't matter why you're here, if you're born in the United States, you're an American citizen. And if so, is that how it's traditionally been interpreted?
That has been traditionally how it's been interpreted. The U.S. Supreme Court has endorsed that interpretation since U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark multiple times. That was a challenge brought by a Chinese man who was born in the United States to two parents who could not naturalize because they were Chinese immigrants. And the Supreme Court has said over and over, yes, we mean very broadly that anyone born on U.S. soil, with very narrow exceptions, are U.S. citizens. The framers of the 14th Amendment, which Trump would like to forget about, there are different sets of constitutional framers. The framers of the 14th Amendment made that provision very broad because they wanted to make sure that after the Civil War, that former slave states couldn't discriminate against African Americans, not just enslaved African Americans who are now free, but African Americans who had always been free. To make clear, they are U.S. citizens, do not discriminate against them. State laws are below U.S. constitutional law. So they're trying to guard against the rollback of rights for all Black people.
And you highlighted an interesting part of this because we've talked about, Native populations, we've talked about African Americans. The third part, immigrants. Historically, what were the attitudes about wanting immigration, considering labor shortages, the size of the land, and the need to actually occupy the land? Has the U.S. generally been supportive of immigration, or have they generally been opposed? Is there a continuity, or is there quite a bit of discontinuity on that question? Do we want immigrants in the United States?
Continuity is that there have been always been sectors of the United States that have wanted immigrants, and there are other sectors that, for racial reasons and anti-religious reasons, don't want certain types of immigrants. Lincoln, in the middle of the Civil War, passes the first federal immigration law, where and it's significant because it's not restrictionist. He's trying to recruit European migrants because there are labor shortages during the Civil War. That bill ends up not working and not going anywhere because the mechanics don't work out. But then at the same time, the Western states don't want Chinese immigrants because they allegedly pose economic competition. So it has always been that, okay, we want immigrants, but not all of them.
And on the Chinese case in particular, I think the Chinese and the Japanese both with this, that on the West Coast, they wanted Chinese laborers, built the railways and, built a whole lot of the West, but wanted to restrict how they would be able to come to the US. And so, for example, guest worker programs. I know Jonathan Spence, for example, has written, histories about the developments of Chinatowns for precisely that reason, that families weren't invited, it was just the laborer who was invited. Was that unique to the West Coast and in particular to East Asian populations, or is that something that was fairly consistent around the country?
That's fairly unique to the West Coast. And yes, there are migrations where it's mostly men at first, like indentured servants into the colonies was mostly men. But later into the 18th century, the gender ratios more or less equal out, but not in Chinese immigration, which begins, what, around the 1850s, reaches significant numbers. It's highly contested. The anti-Chinese sentiment starts locally in California, and then it spills over into national politics to the point where the US government passes, after the feds have taken control over immigration, they passed the first Chinese Immigrant Exclusion Act in 1882. So once we transition to the federal level, where immigration is now federalized and nationalized, it didn't mean more freedom and more immigration. It meant, boom, Chinese exclusion. So it's not really, the federalism story is not a story with a happy ending if you are pro-immigrant.
Our last question, with this segment then is the book is addressing what are the historic roots and the historic foundations that will lead to different citizenship laws like birthright citizenship. I'll ask a deceptively simple question. Does American history support a broad interpretation of birthright citizenship?
So there are many people claiming to be originalists, including a number of them on the Supreme Court. There is good originalism that is faithful to history, and there is bad originalism, which cherry-picks historical data points to reach a legal conclusion. The craft of doing history is there are standards. It's not, oh, there's no correct answers. There are correct answers. And there are parts of history that we don't know because we don't have the evidence. But historical questions are so hard to answer. But the intent of the broad scope of birthright citizenship, if you care to look at the history and of the history that hundreds of historians and political scientists and other legal scholars have looked at, the historical evidence is extremely clear that it does. The framers of the 14th Amendment meant to create a broad citizenship that included even the reviled Chinese immigrants' children and all Black people.
I think that's a great spot to take a break. And when we return, Anna Law is going to be joined by a couple of her colleagues. She's going to be joined by Julie Novkoff and Jack Chin.
When we come back, how do contemporary ideas of birthright citizenship fit with those of the past? And how might those influence the Supreme Court's upcoming decision? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What might influence the Supreme Court's decision on the birthright citizenship case? Will it be historic precedents on the matter or more contemporary ideas? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. So one of the first executive orders the Trump administration made in 2025 was an attempt to overturn this concept of and legal status of birthright citizenship. The Supreme Court actually just recently heard arguments on a lawsuit filed against the executive order as unconstitutional. So our guest in the first segment, Anna Law, is going to be joined by two colleagues specializing in birthright citizenship to discuss the case, the status of birthright citizenship, the legal foundation upon which it's built, and what the future might potentially hold. Julie Novkoff is the Dean of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy and Professor of Political Science and Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University at Albany. She's the author of Donald Trump, Constitutional Failure and the Guardrails of Democracy, and American by Birth, Wong Kim Ark and the Battle for Citizenship. Jack Chin is Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of Clinical Legal Education at UC Davis School of Law. The Supreme Court has cited his work in two cases, Chavez v. United States and Padilla v. Kentucky. Justice Sotomayor cited his law article in Utah v. Strieff. Also, he's the author of Birthright Citizenship, Slave Trade Legislation, and the Origins of Federal Immigration Regulation, and A Nation of White Immigrants, State and Federal Racial Preferences for White non-citizens. And once again, Anna Law joins us. She holds the Herbert Kurtz Chair in Constitutional Rights at CUNY Brooklyn College and the author of the very recently published Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, African Americans, Native Americans, and Immigrants. Thank you all so much for joining us. And Dean Novikov or Julie, I'm going to ask you the first question. This case was just recently presented to overturn birthright citizenship. What were some of the arguments the Trump administration was making, and how do they fit with the historical understanding, the case precedent that we understand about birthright citizenship?
So the arguments are quite interesting. The Trump administration is basically arguing that everybody who has thought about this issue in the past has overlooked some important points in the way that the Constitution works. They are making the claim that the language in the 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction, really doesn't cover individuals who are not in the United States in a relatively permanent and authorized status. So the argument is that people who are domiciled in the United States would only really be considered to be domiciled if they do have that kind of more permanent status, and people who are here on temporary visas or are here without documentation don't really fall under the jurisdiction of the United States, and therefore their children would not be eligible for birthright citizenship.
And Jack Chin, it seems to me, and as I've been reading about this, the administration is trying to shift one of the fundamental, one of the foundational questions about citizenship under the U.S. Constitution, and that is it's the person who's born, not the status of their parents that matter. Is that a fair assessment about what the administration is trying to do?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. They are trying to say that millions of people who have been born in the United States since 1868 and have always been considered citizens, in fact, were not citizens. And presumably their children aren't citizens either, because their theory is that in order to be born a U.S. citizen, you have to have a parent who's a U.S. citizen or at least a lawful permanent resident. On the other hand, the real tricky part of their argument is that the sort of authority that they advance, the reasoning that they advance, is if your parents aren't exclusively allegiant to the United States, then you can't be a citizen. And so that would mean what I'm trying to get at is that their rule doesn't follow from their premise. Their premise is you have to have undivided allegiance in order to the United States in order to give birth to your U.S. citizen child. But that would mean that if your parents were immigrants and had naturalized but had not given up their foreign citizenship, that you wouldn't be a citizen. And it certainly doesn't explain why they say that if you're a lawful permanent resident, you can give birth to a U.S. citizen. So basically, they're saying, we want the rule to be what we would like it to be right now. And it's really up to the president to say who's a citizen or not. And that seems to be the legal premise behind the executive order.
Two really interesting points there. One is dual citizens perhaps can't give birth to American citizens. But the second one is one I kind of want to dig into. And Anna, I'll ask you, so historically, has the president had that type of latitude with respect to defining who's a citizen? Or is this really as much about an overreach of presidential power as it is about definition of citizenship?
Historically, the presidents did not have the authority to define who is a citizen before the Reconstruction Amendments. And we have the instance of the Alien Friends Act, which was one of the laws passed in 1798 with the Alien and Sedition Acts, where John Adams tried to claim deportation power over migrants that he that were not enemy that were from countries that the US was not at war at. Predictably, given the times and given the political situation, the slave states went nuts. They said, "Wait, you want a what now? You want to give the federal government deportation power? What if they deport all our enslaved people?" So the slave states absolutely objected. The northeastern states, which managed the entry and exit of international and interstate migration, also objected because the northeastern states, like Pennsylvania, are trying to recruit voluntary migrants. The idea that the president could then deport them—that this is a non-starter for two very different reasons, from two different parts of the country. So there's no way that the president historically, before federalization, had any sort of ability to determine who is a citizen and who is not. And it's in the Constitution, and cannot be changed by fiat and by executive order alone. And I think the two lawyers, Julie and Jack, can tell you why it's so important that it's not just the law. Birthright citizenship is in the Constitution, and what's the difference?
Yeah, Julie, I was going to follow up with that because I know you've written about Donald Trump and specifically the way the Constitution has guardrails for democracy. Would this fit, that as well, that this is a case of a president who's asserting powers that really could be rather undemocratic?
It's quite breathtaking in the scope of what he is trying to do here. And it does really call into question the relationship of the executive branch under Donald Trump to constitutional structure. As Anna was noting, if you look at the way that the Constitution divides power over immigration, there isn't really power allocated to the executive branch to manage the naturalization process. That's quite clearly placed in Article One and belongs to Congress. There's nothing in the Constitution that grants the president specific power to manage the process of people becoming citizens. So it was an interesting gambit, let's say, for the president to issue an executive order that purports to change the entire basis for citizenship in the United States.
And Jack, we were talking about this in an earlier segment. I want to ask you a question kind of similarly about, has the history of the US and the way that they've approached citizenship, has it generally been welcoming? Are there any continuities about immigration policy? Or has the idea of forms of discrimination or at least preferences, has that been the history?
Definitely. And so President Trump's idea that some people are better than others and that some people should be welcomed as citizens and immigrants and other people should not really harkens back to an uglier racist period of American history, which unfortunately went on for quite a long time. And it begins with the Naturalization Act of 1790, which limited naturalization to free white persons. There was this question before the Civil War of whether African Americans were, if born in the United States, were citizens. Everybody agreed that white people born in the United States were citizens. But how about African Americans? How about other non-whites? And of course, in the infamous Dred Scott versus Sanford case, we got an answer. And the answer from the Supreme Court in 1857 was African Americans, free or enslaved, if born in the United States, are not citizens and can never be citizens. And that view was applauded by some Americans and opposed by many others. And one of the outcomes of the Civil War was to say the people of the United States said we got to overrule Dred Scott and move on from that. But in fairness to President Trump and the racist tradition of citizenship in the United States, we had racially restricted citizenship until 1952, at least as far as naturalized citizens, and we had race-restricted immigration until 1965. And when we put immigration and citizenship on a race-neutral basis, that was something that the elites in Congress and in the executive branch thought was important, in part for geopolitical reasons. But it's not clear that it's been accepted in every corner of the population as a whole. And when I hear "Make America Great Again" and hearken back to an earlier time, it does make me think that the white nationalist component of MAGA maybe does think that things were that the policy was better in the past.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about birthright citizenship, the current case before the Supreme Court, and the history of citizenship with Julie Novikov. She is at the University at Albany, Jack Chin from UC Davis, and Anna Law from CUNY Brooklyn College. And so, Anna, then historically, that's always been one of the tricky parts with the United States, right? If you're tracing the history and tracing immigration, the U.S. history has usually made racial distinctions on immigration. But it seems that the 14th Amendment, at least with respect to birthright citizenship, was trying to address that question, right?
Yes, the US has selected people by race or by national origin. And the 14th Amendment is trying to do the exact opposite. And it's not only selecting people by race, but as Jack mentioned, the legal citizenship status of free Black people born in the United States was not clear until the Birthright Citizenship Clause. So it's not just to bestow citizenship on people who are born after the amendment, but it's to make very crystal clear anyone born in the US, including free Black people, any Black people, were always citizens and they will be US citizens. So it's fighting against, it's going against the tide of racial selection and racial and racist naturalization laws.
Now, Julie, we talk about this a little bit more. I kind of want to dig into this because this notion of originalism suggests that the court should base its judgments, based on the original intent. But there seems to be at least a little bit of a tension, particularly when you talk about the 14th Amendment, because since the 14th Amendment was authored at the end of the Civil War, should originalism focus on the authors of the amendments, or should it trace back historically to the foundations of the Republic? And I ask that because it seems to me, from a Supreme Court perspective, that that's actually been one of the questions that Ketanji Brown Jackson has been raising quite a bit, kind of taking on originalism and saying, but are you really being originalist if you're using an interpretation different than what the authors of the amendment said, as opposed to at the founding? What does originalism mean?
It really means looking into what the authors of the amendment believed themselves to be doing. And sometimes it can be very difficult to understand what was going on. But in other cases, it's relatively clear if you look at the context, if you look at the debates, and if you look at the ways that the amendment is viewed right around the time that it goes into effect. So with respect to the 14th Amendment, you have Congress acting in 1866 to write legislation to grant citizenship clearly to Black people who were born in the United States and to overturn Dred Scott. But Congress, having gotten into some debates with the president at the time, Johnson, realizes that that's not going to secure this right firmly enough. So they go forward and they debate adding a clause to the Constitution that will not only make this clear, but will write it into the Constitution to stand for time immemorial. And in the course of discussing what they're going to do, they talk about whether it's going to be sufficient to write a constitutional clause that will address the specific situation of African Americans in the United States, or if they should use more general language. And some of the opponents of the amendment say, hey, if you don't use specific language, you're going to mean that Chinese people who have children in the United States will be giving birth to citizens. You will have gypsies who are giving birth to citizens. And overall, Congress says, yep, this will mean everyone. It will mean groups that are highly disfavored. At the time that Congress debated and passed the 14th Amendment, there was already some anxiety about Chinese immigration. But nonetheless, Congress went forward and used this universal language. You then take that language and look at how it was understood around that time. The justice who wrote the opinion in Wong Kim Ark was widely understood to be an expert on sovereignty, and he had been a great critic of Dred Scott. And he again looks back at the history, looks at the language of the 14th Amendment, and talks as well about the history of birthright citizenship before the 14th Amendment, noting that part of what the 14th Amendment does is to constitutionalize birthright citizenship and simply expand the principle to include everyone.
And by the way, the Wong Kim Ark case, that's the
Yes.
one where a child of Chinese guest workers that were not allowed to be naturalized but was born in the United States, the Supreme Court ruled that person is an American citizen under birthright citizenship, correct?
Yes, Wong Kim Ark was born to a merchant father and an immigrant mother in San Francisco in the 1870s, and claimed citizenship on that basis.
So we can update this to specifically this case. Jack, it seems, and most of the legal analysts seem to suggest that this is a case, this birthright citizenship case, has been pretty clear. The court has actually not really equivocated very much on this. So I guess there's some expectations that this might be an easier decision for the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court has surprised us. Do you have any sort of concerns about what seems like it might be a pretty straightforward case could be presented in a way that could open up the door to challenges to a pretty sort of clear understanding of birthright citizenship?
This court is definitely capable of surprise. The court is not wedded to precedent in the way that other courts have been. And so presumably they're going to feel free to do what they want to do. But I would be shocked and surprised if the executive order were upheld. One problem, and I think it's a fatal one, is that in 1940, Congress passed a law called the Nationality Act of 1940 that replicated the citizenship clause of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment and made a lot of other people citizens too, like people born in outlying territories, people born in the Canal Zone, things like that. And it was very clear that when Congress passed that law, they thought that they were granting citizenship to everyone born in the United States, except the children of foreign diplomats who were accredited to the United States and children of enemy troops in hostile occupation of the United States. And they got that set of exceptions from Wong Kim Ark, and Wong Kim Ark got it from earlier cases, the most important being an old English case called Calvin's case. And Calvin's case basically said everyone born in the king's domain is a subject of the king, except children of diplomats and children of enemy troops in hostile occupation. And so in 1940, Congress intended to give citizenship to everyone. And so for the executive order to be valid, the Supreme Court is going to have to say, well, Congress meant to do this, but the president has the power to overrule them, or for some reason, We're going to say Congress meant to do this, but we're not going to give effect to what Congress intended to do. We're going to do something else. I think it's very, very unlikely that five justices of the Supreme Court are going to say we reject what we know Congress intended to do. So I think they're going to say, I think there's very little chance that they're going to say that the executive order is valid. And I think there's a very good chance that they'll say that the executive order not only violates the Nationality Act of 1940, but is unconstitutional for basically the same reasons. And the biggest problem is this. If they say that the executive order is valid, it's going to have to be valid for some reason. And maybe it's valid because the president can decide whoever he wants to be a citizen. That wasn't specifically argued, but that's a possibility, I guess. More likely, they would say, look, you've persuaded us that subject to the jurisdiction means not having any foreign allegiance. And so if the parents or the child has some foreign allegiance, they're not a citizen. Nobody noticed this since 1868, but what this means is a proposition that was rejected in Wonkemark is going to be the law, and that is we'll look at foreign law, and if France makes somebody a citizen or Argentina makes somebody a citizen if they're born in the US, they're not our citizen because they're subject to a foreign allegiance. And I think it's extremely unlikely that the US Supreme Court is going to say, going forward, we need to figure out, just being born here is the beginning of an inquiry, and that inquiry will turn on foreign law. Does some foreign law make you a citizen? It'll turn on parental status. Let's look at the parents and see, do they have dual citizenship for some reason? And if so, their kids aren't citizens. One problem with that, Donald Trump wouldn't be a citizen because his, and so I think it's extremely unlikely that they're going to. Even Justice Alito has expressed some sympathy for immigrants in the past, being of Italian heritage himself. I think it's extremely unlikely that they're going to say, gee, maybe children of immigrants, children of dual citizens are not themselves US citizens. And so just because somebody has been born here and lived here for five generations, maybe they're a citizen, maybe they're not. Put another way, it's impossible to imagine that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to do that. And so, if they're looking at this from an original public meaning perspective, are they going to say the framers? No, they didn't mention at the time, but what they really meant was to have a really complicated and uncertain citizenship system that doesn't give you clear answers, that gives you just a series of questions about whether somebody's a citizen or not. They're not going to, I think it's very unlikely that five justices are going to do that.
And Julie, we have about like 90 seconds left. It seems like the court has a chance to check the power of the president, with this as well, but they haven't been inclined to do so. Do you expect that the president's wings are going to be, the power is going to be clipped just a little bit here, or will they try to present it in a way that still kind of preserves executive power?
I would not be surprised if they do try to rein in the administration and Trump himself pretty significantly here. After all, it certainly helps their own claims to legitimacy if they can show that they're not simply walking in lockstep with the administration at all times.
So with that potential, good news, I think, with respect to this, and I think I would share, certainly not a constitutional scholar, but would share that it seems like this one's fairly cut and dried. Yet I would be lying if I didn't say I wasn't concerned, because this court has certainly taken certain cases and presented them in ways that I didn't think they were going to present them. We're going to be able to continue to watch this. Obviously, sometime in the near future, we'll probably get a ruling on birthright citizenship. And I think it's incredibly important, not just about birthright citizenship, but also what does it mean for original intent? What does it mean for the authors of an amendment? And what's striking about all this is we don't have to guess what the authors of the amendment were thinking. There's a congressional debate record of what they were raising with that as well. So if we're going to use history in honor of Ann Law's, recent publication, Let's use good history and make sure that we're not picking and choosing history on the basis of what we want as our outcome. We've been talking about birthright citizenship, the historical foundations of birthright citizenship, the case about birthright citizenship, what it says about executive power, what it says about the nature of what it means to be a citizen. Our guests today have been Julie Novkov. She is the Dean of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy and a professor of political science and women's, gender, and sexuality studies at the University at Albany. She's the author of Donald Trump, Constitutional Failure and the Guardrails of Democracy, and American by Birth, Wong Kim Ark, and the Battle for Citizenship. Jack Chin is Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of Clinical Education at UC Davis's School of Law. He's been cited numerous times in U.S. Supreme Court decisions and is the author of Birthright Citizenship, Slave Trade Legislation, and the Origins of the Federal Immigration Regulation and a Nation of White Immigrants, State and Federal Racial Preferences for White Non-Citizens. And Anna Law, she holds the Herbert Kurtz Chair in Constitutional Rights at CUNY Brooklyn College and the author of the very recently, last month, published Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, African Americans, Native Americans, and immigrants. Thank you all so much for sharing your time and your expertise on this fascinating and incredibly important topic.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.